And you're listening to Unusual Sources here on 93.3 CFMU FM. We have a special theme-based program today about activities related to Israel, discussions within the Jewish community. It's going to be quite interesting. We have guests in the studio, and we'll also have a guest live on air by telephone later in the program. So stay tuned, because in just a couple minutes, we have two interrelated interviews coming right up here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM. And we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM, bringing you the news you don't ordinarily get to hear. And we do have some very special sources with us today for our themed program today, because we have two members of the Independent Jewish Voices, Hamilton chapter. And here in the studio with us, we have Dr. Harry Shannon, a professor here at McMaster. And we also have David Cohen, another member of Independent Jewish Voices, Hamilton chapter. So thanks very much, both of you, for coming in today with us.
Hi, Brendan.
Good to be here, Brendan.
Good, thank you. Well, it's very good to have you here today, because while events related to Israel and discussions within the Canadian Jewish community have been all over the news, in fact, in the last year, you could argue that Canada has become a major battleground for Israeli public relations. And one group at the center of it has been the Independent Jewish Voices, as an independent new voice here in the Jewish community. And there's been a spate of articles from people like Eve Engler and Eric Wahlberg and others about Canada specifically and discussions taking place in Canada. And I know the big news and the most obvious media force for us to talk about today is the Goldstone Report. South African Justice Richard Goldstone has released his report about the conduct of Israeli forces during the incursion into Gaza last year. He's a member of the Constitutional Court in South Africa. He's someone who has experience as an anti-apartheid campaigner, and he's also a Jewish belonging to several Israeli organizations. He didn't want to take on such an emotionally charged topic, but he had to give his he had to give into his professional credentials, in that he really wanted to create an unbiased report for the United Nations. And some people are arguing that he ended up reiterating what's already known about the conflict, but he conducted a thorough, methodical, and unbiased, neutral study as best as he could. And perhaps he repeated what some Israeli dissenters have already said about perhaps the lack of measures to prevent civilian casualties and so on. But, there's a lot we could say about the report, but we've got you here today, and we want to hear your views on that. So I guess what are your initial reactions to what you had read about in the Goldstone Report?
I confess I haven't read the whole thing, but what I have done is read the summary and several other parts of it. I think some of the criticisms are completely invalid. One of the criticisms that I've heard is that the mandate of the mission was biased. In fact, it's not, and I've brought with me a copy of the exact wording so everybody can understand that. The mandate was, and I quote, to investigate all violations of international human rights law and international humanitarian law that might have been committed at any time in the context of the military operations that were conducted in Gaza during the period from 27 December 2008 and 18 January 2009, whether before, during, or after. So even though some people have said it's an anti-Israel mandate, there's absolutely nothing in there to suggest that. There's no mention of Israel, Hamas, Palestinians. It simply says this will be about the conflict in Gaza. Another point I think that's worth making is that Goldstone, in fact, did criticize both sides. He pointed out that Palestinian armed groups had launched rockets into Israel over a period of time. He noted that they had damaged houses, schools, and cars in southern Israel. He said they would constitute war crimes and may amount to crimes against humanity. And he said also that there was no system of public monitoring or accountability for those violations by the Gaza authorities. So he was very critical. Another point, I think, is that some people have said that he wanted to prevent Israel from defending itself. That's not true. What he was doing was taking the war as given. He didn't argue whether the war was justified or not. He simply said that given that a war was conducted, what were the humanitarian and international laws that were applicable, and were any of them broken? And, of course, he was critical of Israel because Israel, by his evidence, broke international laws. Another point to make is that many people have wanted to reject the report out of hand, and I think most of them haven't even read it. A number of the criticisms about the mandate, for example, are written by people who claim to be commenting on the report. Yet the mandate was in the very first paragraph of the report and the very first paragraph of the summary. So anyone who claims to have read the report and actually be commenting on it cannot be telling the truth if they claim that the mandate was biased. I think another interesting point was made by Bradley Burston. He's a writer in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. He wrote, "I put off reading a Goldstone report the same way I put off scheduling a colonoscopy. I realized it was for many of the same reasons. You know it's going to be tremendously uncomfortable. You don't know, you don't want to know what they're going to find, and the consequences could be life-threatening." And then he read it through, end to end. And he said, you know, this is a very fair report. So I think that the criticisms thrown at Goldstone, many of them simply ad hominem attacks, attacking him simply for doing his report and producing it with nothing about the report itself, they, to me, are completely invalid, and I believe the Goldstone report is a very important document and a very fair one.
Well, I don't have very much to add to that, except that, I mean, I'm just looking at something you gave me about the commentary of Richard Falk, and he points out that he says in many ways the Goldstone report endorses the misleading main line of the Israeli narrative by assuming that Israel was acting in self-defense against a terrorist adversary. The report focuses its criticism on Israel's excessive and indiscriminate use of force. And that is what my impression was when I have to admit that I've only glanced at some of the report, but it's mainly about Israel's excessive use of force. And it certainly, as Harry has said, there's criticism of both sides. But I think that is what is giving a lot of people trouble about this report on the Israeli side and as well as elsewhere.
Well, I think you've both shown that it was an even-handed report, at least as much as Goldstone could have done. I think he was trying to give Israel the benefit of the doubt as much as he could have. He knew that he would be facing criticism, so he really extended himself in that manner to do that. Nonetheless, his report and his investigation unearthed details which perhaps were not surprising, but were details that Israel was not pleased to have openly discussed. And I think looking at the report and what he had to say, we had, a fairly predictable reaction by Israel and also the United States. I understand the report was being brought before the United Nations, if I understand correctly. Were Israel and the United States trying to block or deflect that report?
Well, in fact, yes, I believe they were. And in fact, at least initially, the Palestinians were also guilty of that. So I think that we shouldn't just be blaming the one side here. I think it is also worth pointing out that Goldstone wasn't given access to Israel. He wasn't allowed to get into Israel or to the West Bank. So in some ways it's quite galling for Israel to criticize him for not reporting on what happened to the Israelis when he wasn't even allowed to get in and speak to people in places like Sderot, which had come under rocket fire from Gaza. But David makes the important point that Israel went way beyond what was needed for security purposes. There was enormous damage to infrastructure. There was enormous damage to housing and schools. Even a UN building was damaged. So they went, unfortunately, the Israelis went well beyond what they needed to for security.
I think this report may confirm what a lot of people thought about this whole episode while it was happening. It was described as a war, but interviews with Israeli soldiers who took part in it after it seemed to indicate that there wasn't really any opposition. It was simply an all-out attack using very sophisticated weaponry, and there was hardly any opposition. And I think Goldstone is really just a rendering of a lot of very awful stuff done to essentially a civilian population.
Well, I think Harriet brings up an interesting point about the response of one of the Palestinian governments to that. And certainly, if you look at Counterpunch over the last week, there's at least one excellent article there criticizing the Palestinian Authority for the way in which it also tried to cooperate with Israel in initially suppressing that. Well, they had a confused reaction to that, and it's definitely worth reading Counterpunch over the last week, looking for the article about the Palestinian Authority's response to the Goldstone Report. Very interesting. Now, David, yes, you mentioned how the Goldstone Report is a rendering of what occurred during that war. It was, as soon as he was asked to write that report, it was inevitable that many of those events that happened would be crystallized into a kind of report that would be very uncomfortable to discuss. Now, I guess what I'm interested in is the possible implications of this report, because this is an international or United Nations study, and it has made reference to instances in which Israel did not take sufficient measures to prevent, for example, the loss of civilian life. Certainly actions that Israel doesn't really want to discuss. So now that it's been opened up and all the countries in the world have been able to read this report and that it's now public domain, I guess my question is, what possible effect might this have if this is recognized as a sort of official UN or global report on the situation? Is this something that will change people's perceptions, or does it reflect perhaps the way people's perceptions have already been changing? Where does it fit into in the way that people globally perceive the actions of the Israeli government?
Well, I think, first of all, it's as has been indicated, I think you've mentioned, I mean, the report is having a significant impact on the Israeli government, first of all. Okay, I think that they're finding it difficult to respond to some of this stuff. Now, but what will other people think? What will other governments think? Well, it remains to be seen. You know, there have been other episodes, the one in Lebanon previous to this, and so on. I mean, does this have an impact on Israel's reputation? It could, but what are the actual hard results from it? I'm not sure. But certainly, this report, its thoroughness, as Harry has made very clear, the fact that the person who did it was almost bent over backwards to be impartial, I think that this will have some impact on how people view Israel and its conflict with the Palestinians.
I think David is right in this. Certainly, even back in March, there was a story in Haaretz reporting that the Israeli government were going to have trouble justifying the extent of destruction in Gaza. And I think, more importantly, for the world in general, this was something of a watershed. I think people had supported Israel or felt that it was under pressure. There were terrorists who conducted some horrific bombings inside Israel, and so the security argument seemed to be paramount. But I think Israel went so far beyond the security needs with Gaza that it became almost impossible for people to justify it on those grounds. I've already mentioned some of the destruction, most of which has still not been repaired because concrete supplies cannot get in. Now, we haven't even talked about the justification for the conflict and for the war. And if you want, we could get into that. But at the moment, I think I would just say that the conflict overall, the war that happened at the beginning of the year, the end of December, beginning of the year, has had a major impact on the world. And I've talked to a number of people who I think would have justified some of what Israel does up to now, but they found Gaza just too much to stomach.
An obvious constituency, if that's the word, for reacting to this report are Jews. Jews within Israel, and Jews in the so-called diaspora. What will the impact be on them? I think that Jews generally are subject to Israeli propaganda. But in this case, I think Israel has a very difficult job of convincing Jews, Canadian Jews, American Jews, that this report is biased, that this report is unfair, or this report is untrue. I think that most Jews, I think, you know, will see that, you know, this report was by someone like them, someone living outside of Israel who is sympathetic to Israel, but who, when looking at it honestly, looking at this particular event, this incursion to Gaza, found a lot of things that were awfully wrong. So I think it remains to be seen how this is going to play out in Canada, in Hamilton, in places like that, where I think, you know, Jews of who have essentially, you know, fundamental sympathy for Israel, will I think want to look at will be looking at the report. We'll be reading it, I hope, and will I think perhaps have a different outlook. Somewhat different outlook, anyway.
Well, I think we should address those two issues in order before we go. And starting on what Harry was bringing attention to, the incursion into Gaza that occurred last year, Israel had to justify that. And I understand they made references to rocket attacks and repeated rocket attacks. And it was a tit-for-tat thing and moral equivalency and so forth. So they created security justification based on these concerns in order to stage their attack. And of course, in discussions on this radio program, we know that a motivating factor for the incursion that is not discussed as much, of course, was the election of Hamas, which was a situation that Israel desired to rectify. And perhaps that incursion was one manner of doing so. But certainly Israel has had to provide justification for what it did. And that comes up in any discussion of the Goldstone report. So, well, Harry, what is your perspective on the manner in which Israel has been justifying their decisions?
Yeah. Well, I think there were essentially several comments made before the conflict. Firstly, that it was Hamas that started the latest round just before the conflict started. That Israel only responds when provoked, that Israel has been taking it for a long time, and the humanitarian tragedy was not Israel's fault. Unfortunately, the evidence suggests otherwise. There had been a ceasefire, and Hamas had been adhering to that. There were, to be sure, one or two rockets, but apparently they came from rogue groups, and Hamas was actually praised by an Israeli intelligence group for its role in trying to make sure that they were suppressed. The notion also, people said before the conflict that well, Israel's had these rocket attacks for the last 8 years, and it's time we did something. Well, a lot had been done. It wasn't as if Israel had been sitting there taking it for all that time. In fact, thousands of Palestinians were killed over that period. And as the Goldstone report points out, there might have been 8,000 rockets from Gaza into Israel. But in one short period, less than 2 years, within that 8 year period, Israel fired 15,000 rockets into Gaza. So if we're looking at proportionality, clearly there's a huge difference. In terms of a humanitarian tragedy, that was partly due to the blockade that was enforcing Gaza for quite a long time and was intensified after Hamas's election. I think that was the beginning of 2006. That has completely strangled the economy there. But more importantly, it's prevented even things like food getting into Gaza. So Israel, actually, one ridiculous example of a security concern was that pasta was prevented from entering Gaza on security grounds. This is ludicrous, of course. Also, Gazans had trouble getting out to get medical treatment. The hospitals there are in terrible shape. I was actually in Gaza in July last year before the conflict and visited a hospital where even the most basic supplies were either non-existent or in very short supply. As well, Israel asks, has been asking civilians who want to get out of Gaza to get treatment for severe medical conditions, to that they should become informants or spies. And Physicians for Human Rights Israel wrote a report on this, and they referred to it as medical extortion. So there are a number of things that were going on before the conflict. It wasn't the story we heard. Certainly there was rocket fire. I regard the rocket fire from Gaza as war crimes. They're violations of international humanitarian law. And the people of Sderot, to be in Israel, were absolutely fed up with this, and I can't blame them. But nevertheless, Israel had been responding before this. Had they opened the borders and allowed the Gazan economy to flourish, people to get food and basic supplies and able to repair their homes, many of which I went to Rafah, which is at the south end. I drove around. There was street after street after street. Almost every house devastated, certainly no house without major damage. And so it's no wonder these people want to lash out. That's not an excuse for it, but it's a very clear explanation. And even many Israelis from the military have said that if we, Israel, relaxed a blockade, we could stop the rocket fire. There was at least one or two people saying that before the Gaza conflict.
Yes, and I think there's a lot of depth to the conflict in that regard, and that's increasingly being understood globally. And I guess before we go, we should address the other issue that David brought up, and that is the Goldstone Report. This whole conflict, the latest incursion into Gaza, was very visible, and everyone had to react in a way to it because it was all over the 24/7 news cycle, so everyone saw it. And people who held opinions on Israel that perhaps were very, very pro-Israeli in that one-sided sense, or perhaps people who did not have a strong opinion, might have experienced a change in their opinion. And it's not only North Americans generally, but within the Jewish community, there's been a growing divide between the position of the Israeli government and many North American Jews who have become increasingly upset. And as members of the IJV, you're well positioned to discuss some of this new dissent and the new voices that are coming out about this. I understand Goldstone faced pressure from the Israeli government, even though Goldstone is Jewish, and certainly the Israeli government and Israeli government organizations or affiliated organizations do not flinch from criticizing Jews who criticize Israel. They don't flinch from criticizing on a personal level, in an ad hominem manner, Jewish critics of it. So I know Goldstone faced certain kinds of predictable criticism. Now, here in Canada, the Independent Jewish Voices has been engaged in many activities, and I understand the National Post had been reporting on the conflict like everyone else with regard to the incursion into Gaza, and then the debate over that, and then the Goldstone Report possibly, and they started focusing on the IJV itself, the leadership and members and positions of it. And I guess, how would you characterize it in the last two or three months, at least since the beginning of September, the manner in which you feel the organization has been treated or addressed in news organizations such as the National Post, and what kind of commentary or criticism you think it's been receiving from mainstream or conservative Jewish organizations?
Well, members of IJV certainly know how Judge Goldstone feels, because several of our people have been under attack, it doesn't feel good to be under attack by the media, and probably it feels less good to be under attack by Jews, your fellow Jews. But the thing is that IJV, the fundamental reason for it is that the motivating factor behind IJV is to speak out and to give voice to Jews who live in Canada and the United States and other places, where actually the model for IJV Canada was IJV in British or England, UK, and there's also, I believe, an IJV in Australia, to give voice. To Jews who live in the so-called diaspora, but who have a different point of view, and a somewhat critical point of view of what Israel is doing. So at times, doing what we do brings criticism, and some of it is very harsh. So we have certainly had that in the last little while, but there's a resolve to keep going, and we have events planned. We have a couple of events planned in Hamilton. November 12th, there'll be a speaker coming in, Mark Ellis, a noted theologian, and.
Yes, on November 17th, there's Rita Jackerman, who's at the Institute of Community and Public Health in Ramallah on the West Bank. Perhaps I can just add one thing to what David, or a couple of things to what David was saying. The notion of dissent within the Jewish community. Brian Klug, who's a philosopher at Oxford, has just written a book about this, and he points out that it's in the grand Jewish tradition to be able to discuss, debate. And he also points out that it's fundamentally anti-Jewish to start attacking people on these grounds. When I was growing up in Cheder, that's Jewish Hebrew classes, religious classes, I remember being taught how humiliating someone in public is one of the worst things you can do to someone. And Brian Klug makes essentially the same point in his book. The other point is that the attacks on individuals and on the organization, I think, is a diversionary tactic. It takes attention away from the real issue, which is how is Israel treating Palestinians? And I think we always have to get back to that, because if we don't, if we start getting involved in internal debates, we'll lose focus. We'll take our eyes off the prize.
Absolutely. And that's a wonderful way to be thinking as we end on this segment of the program. You mentioned Brian Klug, and I believe his new book is coming out, The Fence, The Jewish Case. And I had an excerpt from that. He says, in a way, I am glad of it, the criticism he receives from Jews, because he says, being othered reminds me that I am a Jew, especially when I consider what provoked this behavior, the expression of open dissent about the state of Israel. For what does this mean? What does it mean when you're expected to stand solidly with a state, when you must declare that you love it before you may question it, when criticism must always be balanced with praise, when all the fears and hopes of the people are placed in its hands, and so on. He says, so you cross any line in order to speak out about the degradation of others. This is a rule in the Judaism to which I lay claim. So you do not infringe this rule, which is that you should cross any line in order to speak about the degradation of others. You do not infringe this rule to support a state, whatever your attachment to that state. So if there's anything that Jews should always support, it is justice, not a state, and especially not a state that sports the name Israel. And he goes on as to why he believes this. So I believe he's put forward a very impassioned critique and a very impassioned investigation of all of this. So I thank you very much for bringing attention to that. So David and Harry, thank you both for coming in today. This is a wonderful perspective you've brought to us, and it's great to have you both in the studio. We're going to be discussing related issues later in the program, and thank you so much for making this all possible today.
Okay, you're welcome. Thanks for having us on the program.
Thank you, Brendan.